and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned there's a better way to tie your shoelaces. So there's basically one knot that we all use to tie our shoe, a version of the square knot. But researchers from Williams College in Massachusetts found that there is a weak version and a strong version. They did this in a study that answered the age-old question, why do our shoelaces always come undone? So we've all basically been using the weak version of this knot, and to quickly confirm that you have in fact been duped, you can check your shoelaces. The bows are the indicator. Pull the mouth of your shoe outward to sort of force the bows into their natural position, and if they line up with the long part of your shoe, well, you're doing it wrong. When using the strong knot, the bows fall neatly across the shoe. There's actually a TED Talk video from Terry Moore who can give you a better visual.
Simply go the other direction around the bow. We get this, the strong form of the knot. And if you...
So this actually took me a few tries to figure out, but I'm going to try and walk you through it quickly. You want to get to the point where you have a bow in your right hand. Now, normally, you would take the other shoelace and wrap it behind the bow and around. But this time, you're going to take that shoelace and wrap it in front of the bow and come all the way around. Now, the next move is key. When you bend the other shoelace into a bow and stick it through the hole, you want to make sure the new bow is going in front of the old bow. I'm telling you, it should feel awkward. Your instinct will be to go behind, but fight it. When you pull the two bows tight, you'll have a strong, square knot and two neatly tied bows lying across your shoe. Now, here's the twist. Both knots are still going to come undone. When researchers did the study, they found that the stronger knot did fare better in tests, failing only half the amount of time as the weaker knot. Researchers found two things are happening when you walk or run that untie your shoelaces pretty much every time. First, the force with which your foot hits the ground is surprisingly brutal. When running, your foot strikes the ground at 7 times the force of gravity, and the knot stretches and relaxes in response to that force. As the knot loosens, the free ends of the laces are drawn rapidly into the inertial force of your swinging legs. The striking movement takes the most time, but once the knot is loose, it takes as few as 2 strides for your leg's inertial force to pull that knot apart. Further tests revealed that just the G-force or just the inertial force were no match for the knot. So, to keep those knots in check, try the strong version or just double knot the thing. This week I learned that the new Supreme Court justices are hazed by their elders.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch, do solemnly swear
that I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect.
On April 10th, Neil Gorsuch became the 113th Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's an incredible honor that comes with both great responsibilities and a few humbling tasks. Justice Gorsuch replaces Justice Elena Kagan as the lowest on the high court totem pole. And during a talk last year, Justice Kagan explained the 3 jobs she'll be passing on to Gorsuch as part of his judicial rite of passage. First, the newest justice is assigned to cafeteria duty. That means being a member of the court's cafeteria committee. You attend monthly meetings where you discuss the merits of different chocolate chip cookie recipes, among other important, tasty topics. And when the justices lunch together on oral arguments day, the committee member must field complaints, like the soup was too salty, the fish too bland, the rice dish too spicy, and report back to the kitchen. The second humbling task is to take notes and keep quiet during private justice meetings. These important get-togethers are built around hierarchy. The Chief Justice speaks first, and then the justices who speak next go in order of seniority. Meanwhile, the most junior justice listens, keeps the official vote, and takes notes for everyone else. Finally, the third task is getting the door. This pertains again to the private meetings with the justices, which take place in the court's conference room, which is really like an inner sanctum. No other staff member is allowed. But of course, there are interruptions. Someone steps out to get a coffee, or a staff member delivers a file, and there's a knock on the door. Well, it's the junior justice's job to get up and open the door. Even if he is in the middle of a sentence, he'll have to stop what he's doing. Or if he hasn't even heard it, the whole room will pause and stare at him until he goes up to get the door. These junior tasks can go on for years or even decades, depending on when the next justice is sworn in. So they can often be hard habits to break. Previous junior justices have been known to continue to leap up from their chairs at the slightest knocking sound. But after 6 years in this spot, Justice Kagan can now rest easy and let Justice Gorsuch get the door. This week I learned that women were, until all too recently, forbidden from wearing pants on the Senate floor. Yep, it was an unwritten rule that was strictly enforced until 1993. The history of political fashion for women is an odd one. By the late 19th century, it was customary for male senators to dress in formal clothes. Vests, coats, trousers, what have you. They could basically do what they wanted, but outfits met a certain standard of formal decorum. Some senior senators would often school junior senators if their dress did not reflect the dignity of the legislative chamber. The first woman to join Congress was Representative Jeanette Rankin, a Republican from Montana, in 1917. After that, in the few decades to follow, female politicians wore dark, sedate, conservative dresses so they wouldn't stand out. As women began to serve in the House in larger numbers, a similar fashion hierarchy presented itself. Senior congresswomen would school junior ones on how to dress appropriately. But pants were still taboo. The very brief history of women wearing pants is that they didn't. Because mainly the clothing too closely resembled, or men thought they resembled, the balloonish undergarments women had to wear at the time. Anything resembling pants were deemed inappropriate. The 19th century did eventually introduce the needs-based pants for women, pants for industrial work or riding horses. But it really wasn't until the mid-20th century that pants as leisure wear for women became a thing, and pants in the workplace and certainly in the political sphere took several more decades. Fashion norms did change in the House of Representatives first. It was Representative Charlotte T. Reed, a Republican from Illinois, who first walked into work wearing pants in 1969. Rumor has it that one male colleague was so shocked he went out of his way to see the trouser-wearing congresswoman for himself. Then, in 1972, First Lady Pat Nixon broke that sartorial glass ceiling when she wore pants in a fashion spread. She was the first sitting First Lady to be photographed publicly wearing trousers. But the Senate remained steadfast in its dress code. As the upper house in the U.S. legislature, the Senate has always been more formal and reserved than the House. Individual Senate houses did have their own rules, but pants were off-limits for women on the Senate floor. According to one senator, women would even keep dresses handy should they be called to Congress in a moment's notice. Things finally did change for female senators after November 1992. This was when four women won Senate seats, bringing the tally up to a whopping six female senators, the most ever. Early in 1993, Senator Carol Mosley Braun, a new Democrat from Illinois, decided to wear a pantsuit, something she did regularly in the state Senate. Not long after, Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski did the same thing, and with that, Mikulski and Mosley Braun set a precedent. Soon, not only senators, but female staffers followed suit. It was, in no uncertain terms, a pantsuit revolution. This week I learned that growing up with a dog could make you immune to obesity and allergies. A study out of the University of Alberta looked at the effects pets have on a baby's immune system. The vast majority of the families studied had dogs, but overall, researchers found that exposure to pets, both while the baby was in the womb and in the first months after birth, increases the abundance of two very important gut bacteria. One, which is called rheuminococcus, is linked with reduced childhood allergies, and the other, which is called O. coelospira, is linked to reduced obesity. What's really remarkable, though, is that the effect on the baby's gut doesn't take long. Even if the dog is given away just before birth or a few months after, the baby will still have those immunity-boosting bacteria. Researchers say that there's this crucial early window of time for babies, when their gut immunity and microbes co-develop, both in utero and in the first few months after birth. The theory is that if a baby is exposed to some dirt and bacteria from a dog's fur or paws, the baby has the chance to develop an early immunity to certain ailments. There's a lot that is still unknown about this connection between pets and the immune-boosting microbes, but scientists speculate that there could be a time in the near future when the pharmaceutical industry tries to replicate the healthful effects of dogs and make some sort of dog in a pill as preventative medicine for allergies or obesity. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned or to check out that How to Tie Your Shoelace video, go to theweek.com/podcasts. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to offer you 4 totally free non-commitment issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.